I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are going to talk in the first part of this hour about the Troy Davis case, which is very important for us to revisit. A man in Atlanta, Georgia, about to be executed for a crime he did not commit, it appears. And before we go to talk to Troy Davis's attorney and his sister, I want to remind you that I'm going to let all of you know about a great event coming up that I hope you'll be part of. On Wednesday, May 27th, I want you to join me at 6 p.m., for a live broadcast of The Mark Steiner Show from the Murphy Fine Arts Center at Morgan State University. I'll be interviewing Bob Luke, author of the new book from Johns Hopkins Press on the Baltimore Elite Giants. Joining us on stage will be Bert Simmons, who was a pitcher on that team. The live broadcast will be followed by a book signing and a reception. I want you to join us. The event is free, open to the public. You can go to www.steinershow.org or call 410-516-4162 for more information as we explore an evening on the Negro Baseball Leagues with one of its greats and a man who wrote about the Baltimore Elite Giants, our own team in that league. All right, folks, we are now going to talk to Martina Correa, who is Troy Davis's sister and an anti-death penalty activist, and to Deirdre O'Connor, director of Innocence Matters and attorney who assisted in the Troy Davis case. And Martina and Deirdre, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you for having us.
So I saw just the other day, of course, that this case is could be winding down. The appeals have been denied. Let me start, Deirdre, if I might, with you. Talk to us about the case and where we are now. Now, for our listeners, Troy Davis was convicted of murdering a Georgia police officer in 1991. Two decades later, the case remains, he remains on death row, even though the case against him legally seems to have fallen apart completely. But he may be executed very shortly, because all of the appeals have been turned down. So, Deirdre, tell us what's going on. Deirdre O'Connor.
Well, thank you again for having me. Right now, the lawyers are preparing to file a petition in the United States Supreme Court advancing Mr. Davis's innocence claim under the case of Herrera v. Collins, which suggests the possibility of a freestanding innocence claim. It's a very unusual writ. The court does not... It very seldom exercises its original jurisdiction. This is the only legal avenue available to Mr. Davis at this point. So obviously a lot of energy is being put into the briefs to make sure that the court understands the very important consequences if they don't take action in this case. So if they do consider this petition, there's depending on how long it takes for them to reach that decision, there's likely to be an additional stay while the court is considering the case.
And Martina Correa, the sister of Troy Davis, I appreciate you being back on the show with us, and I'm sorry for all the stuff you're going through, but I also I'm really amazed at the way you're standing up to all this, given all the issues you've also had to face in your own life, medically and otherwise.
Yes.
But talk to us a bit about this case. For those people who may be just tuning in for the first time, not know about this case, I mean, they can go to Amnesty International USA and Troy Davis and see what's going on in this case. But explain to us what happened to your brother and where we are now.
Well, back in 1989, I mean, my brother was downtown with some other people that he know playing pool. And a disturbance took place up the street where a homeless man was being attacked and pistol whipped in a parking lot. And my brother, 19 at the time, and a 16-year-old went to find out what was going on. Troy tried to intercede. And the person that was in the parking lot, his name was Sylvester Red Coles. And, you know, when he tried to intercede, you know, apparently he threatened my brother and they took off running. Well, a young lady of the boy of the man that was being pistol whipped, she went into the Burger King parking lot where they were. It's like 12:30 in the morning, and she got the off-duty police officer. He comes running out to see what the disturbance is, and he's subsequently shot and killed. And everybody's running. Nobody knows what's going on. I mean, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. It's a very dim lit parking lot, and you know everybody runs away. Including Sylvester Red Coles. And, you know, nobody knew what happened. Witnesses were describing Coles, describing his actions as a shooter. And I think he got paranoid. And, you know, he went to the police department the next day sometime with a lawyer, and he pointed the finger at my brother. And when he pointed the finger at my brother, the whole case turned on my brother. Cole didn't even tell the police till sometime later that he had a 38 caliber weapon, the same weapon that the police officer was killed with, that's never been found, never been tested, never been retrieved. They never put him in a lineup or anything. And they went to my mother's home and took a picture of my brother out of a photo album, and the next day put it up on a wanted poster, wanted dead or alive cop killer. They hadn't even talked to Troy. To this day, my brother has not been interrogated by the Savannah Police Department about any participation or not participation in this crime. They just took Sylvester Red Cole's word hook, sink, and you know, and the thing about it, they used 9 non-police eyewitnesses to testify against my brother. Most of them had criminal background, young people, so they were very easy to manipulate, threaten with jail time themselves. And Sylvester Red Cole's, of course, you know, he was the one pointing the finger at Troy. Well, when Troy was convicted in 1991, from 1991 to 1996, my brother had no attorneys because Newt Gingrich had defunded the resource centers. And so he had no attorneys during the most pivotal parts of his appeals. But witnesses start coming forward subsequently saying they lied, that their original testimony wasn't truth, that it was coerced, that it was forced, and they were afraid, they were intimidated, and that they didn't see Troy kill the police officer, and that, you know, the actions that they were describing were of Sylvester Coles. And then 9 other witnesses came forward that had never been heard. And they said that, you know, Coles had been involved either by seeing it themselves or he had bragged about the murder to them. And what we've been trying to do over the years is getting a court to listen to this evidence and saying this is important, because my brother was convicted solely on the basis of eyewitness testimony. No weapon, no DNA, no physical evidence, no motive linking Troy to this murder. And now that 7 of these witnesses have come forward and say that they lied, the 8th witness only knew that the shooter was left-handed, and Sylvester Coles is the only other person that's saying that Troy did it, and other witnesses are saying that he is the actual shooter, and the courts are saying, well, because of the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act, you don't have to listen to this. But they can go to, you know, like you said, Amnesty's website, and they can look up a report called Where is the Justice for Me? And they can read the witness statements where the witnesses are saying how they were coerced, what the police threatened them with. And it's amazing that other cases in Georgia are overturned with 1 recantation, nowhere near the innocence that Troy's has. But it's like they're mad because we're challenging the system. We're exposing them under a prosecutor who's been cited for misconduct multiple times.
We're listening to Martina Correa, who is sister of Troy Davis, who may be executed very shortly for a crime many people think now he did not commit. Deirdre O'Connor is with us, who's director of Innocence Matters, attorney who has assisted in the Troy Davis case. And Deirdre, to bring you back in, I mean, the April 16th, the 11th Circuit Court denied Davis's petition, issued a 30-day stay so he can file his last appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court, as you just described. And I wonder, just in terms of the law and what's going on here, how, in light of what Martina said and the issues we talked about the last time everybody was on the show talking about Troy Davis's case, that it could have gotten this far without any retrial or without somebody kind of questioning the justice of this.
Well, I think that that's the thing that is really difficult for the average person to understand, because just as from a common sense perspective, clearly this man deserves a new trial. The thing that happens in the judicial system is that once you're convicted on appeal in any or habeas litigation, the courts presume the conviction to be valid. And what we're finding out now with these innocence cases is, and what Herrera says, the Supreme Court case that stands for the proposition that there may be a freestanding innocence claim, is that when you have evidence of innocence, you've not only got to look at the new evidence, but you've got to go back at the trial and see whether the evidence that the jury relied upon was worthy of their trust. And that hasn't happened in this case. The 11th Circuit said, oh, well, we can rest assured because there's still this one witness remaining. Actually, they point to 2 witnesses who hasn't recanted. It's Stephen Sanders. He's a man who, at the night of the shooting, was unable to identify the shooter. He said to the police, there's no way I'm going to be able to identify anybody except for their clothing. A month later, the police came to him and said, you know, can you give this a try? Do you think you'll be able to identify the shooter? And they had a photo array that they could have shown him. He said to them, no, I'm not going to be able to identify the shooter. They didn't even show him the photo array, which consists of five photos, one of which included Troy. Instead, they let it go for 2 years and brought him into trial and said to him on the stand, with Troy Davis being the only person sitting there accused of the crime, they said to Mr. Sanders, well, do you think there's any way possible you could identify the shooter? And, of course, Mr. Sanders identified Troy Davis. But there is no one that has the slightest bit of common sense that would say that that's a reliable identification. And yet the courts, both the Georgia Supreme Court and the 11th Circuit, were content to rely on that. And I should point out, just a slim majority of each court were. The dissent in both cases are scathing. And they point out how flawed the reasoning is to say that Stephen Sanders is a credible identification.
So,
go ahead.
Okay, but you're about to say something, Martina? I'm sorry.
No, Deidre was speaking.
Oh, I'm sorry, Deidre. Finish what you were saying then. I apologize. Go ahead.
Well, I just think that has been the quintessential hurdle for every innocent person. And, to get the courts to say that let's look at the underlying evidence that was supported the verdict. And in this particular case, there's four jurors who submitted affidavits saying, gosh, if we knew now then what we know now, we would not have convicted Mr. Davis. And, that is critical, that you can't lock in time forever the mistakes of the past.
Well, so
go ahead, I'm sorry.
The question is, so what happens now? I mean, if the Supreme Court does not hear the case, or denies his case, if they do hear it, then what happens next? What can be done to stop the execution?
Well, there's many people that could step up to the plate and do the right thing here. Chief among them is the new district attorney in Chatham County, Larry Chisholm. He has the power to reopen the case and investigate the quality of the investigation, of the original investigation, and to determine whether or not there should be a new trial. And he is more likely than anybody, any player in the case, to consider that, because he doesn't have a vested interest in the conviction. He doesn't have a personal stake in maintaining the conviction. It is what any decent district attorney should do, because their responsibility as a district attorney to the public is to be a minister of justice. It's not to defend a seriously flawed conviction.
So before we have to move on to in this program, Martina Correa, I want you to talk a bit about, for a second, what people can do now to let voices be heard, so the people
ahead.
People that Deidre O'Connor were mentioning can be influenced by the public.
Well, I'm asking everyone that they can write to their U.S. Congress people and congressmen, to the U.S. Black Caucus, the Georgia Black Caucus, and ask them to get involved, because I'm asking people to write or call or send faxes, not only to, the amnesty petition, but to Larry Chisholm, the new DA, because he ran on accountability and openness and fairness. He said that he had problems with the Troy Davis case, and that, black cases and white cases were handled different in Chatham County, and that would be no more. But now that he's in office, I think he's afraid that, if he does the right thing, he won't have political cover. But if you look at a lot of cases of people that are exonerated, just like Mr. House the other day, a court after court after court, all appellate courts, federal courts, even sometimes the Supreme Court, have denied these people. And if it wasn't for the fact of DNA, or by some other small chance that something happened, that they're alive today. And you don't see these courts apologizing when they made a mistake, when somebody's been exonerated after they've turned them down. And Troy's case is the same. But I ask people to go to Amnesty's website. They can read about the case. Go to TroyAnthonyDavis.org. Please call the district attorney in Savannah, Georgia, and say, look, We support you for doing the right thing. Other district attorneys have done it, and people support them. Also write their U.S. Congress people and let them know that this Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act is really hampering the appellate and habeas system and not protecting the innocent. You know, it's really appalling to me to understand that the United States Constitution states it is not unlawful to execute the innocent in this country. And that's a very dangerous thing.
Deirdre Correa, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and Martina Correa and Deirdre O'Connor. Is there a website very quick we can give people can hook, log on to be involved?
www.troyanthonydavis.org or www.aiusa.org/Troy. That's for Amnesty International or Georgians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. They can just Google the name Troy Anthony Davis, death row inmate, and they'll find anything they need to find about this case. And on Troy's site, they can find a lot.
We will check in with you next week, and we'll have you back if we need to, if we have to keep making the public aware of what's happening to Troy Davis. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
And good luck. We'll be right back. And when we come back, we're going to talk about an interesting play in town called No Child, and it's just... You wait. You don't want to miss this one. It's going to be very interesting. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we're going to, as we do on this program, focus on theater in our community. There's so much wonderful theater in this town that goes unseen. The arts are not supported enough. We need to support the arts. We want to keep them alive. And one of the places that's happening in Baltimore is at the Creative Alliance, one of the most interesting venues we have in this city. A play is is coming up this weekend. At the Creative Alliance. It was written by Nalaja Sun, who performed it as a one-woman play, I think, starting in 2006. It's an amazing play, very powerful. This is being done, though, differently with a cast of actors doing these characters. She did 18 characters, rather, right?
16.
16 characters. We're joined in studio right now by Rosalind Cawthon, who is director of No Child. And it's going to be at the Creative Alliance Friday and Saturday at 8 o'clock. Tracy Jiggets is with us.
Yes.
Who plays Miss Sun. Rondi in the play. And Rondi Vick is with us, who plays the narrator of the play, the janitor Baron.
Yes.
Is that right? Do I have all that right?
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay, make sure I just knew what I was talking about. sometimes I don't. But let's talk about this play. So, now, Rosalind, you're directing this play.
Yes.
So this is a play that was really made famous by Nalaja Sun, because it was this one-woman powerful piece,
yes,
where she jumped between characters, and it's everything from an Irish-American, I think it was, a school's principal, to a old African-American janitor, and everything in between.
Yes.
So talk about your vision for this play and why you're doing it so differently.
Yes. Well, it's been a lot of fun working with this ensemble cast of Kaumba Collective for the show. And
what's the collective's name again?
Kaumba.
Kaumba.
Right, which means creativity in Swahili. Mm-hmm. And what's so exciting about it is there are so many characters to play around with. We have about 8 actors, but most of the actors are playing more than one role. So they still have the opportunity to feel the in and out of different characters.
Mm-hmm.
And just having the energy of... really 8 amazing, talented performers on this piece to tackle this piece and sort of deconstruct what Nalaja Sun did with it. She did an awesome job, but to bring it something fresh and new, and it's been a great time.
That's what we do in theater. We bring
yes,
a different interpretation. So explain to our listeners about this play, what Nalaja did with this, created here, and what this play is saying, and then we'll kind of turn to our actors who are here in the studio as well.
Okay, great. Well, what I feel is really important about the play is she's addressing the No Child Left Behind legislation. She was a teaching artist for about 10 years in New York City and experienced all of the ups and downs that many teachers as well as teaching artists experience. And she decided to create this play. She was given a grant to do it from the Department of Education in New York City. And I think what's most important about this play is, as you mentioned, the arts are so important in our schools. And so often, a lot of people don't realize how the arts can grab the students, challenge them, make them passionate just about life in general through theater. So I think the big thing that she is saying is that we, the artists, have to take the time to go into our schools and engage with our young people and excite them about the creative aspects, whether it's theater or dance or visual arts. That is all of our responsibility to help our kids.
And this character she plays, this teacher that she plays, that is your character, Tracy Jiggs, right? Jiggs, right?
Yes, Miss Sun.
Miss Sun. Came to teach this class with a play that was Australian, had nothing to do with them, and the class revolts against her. So talk about your character and what this, in this play.
Well, basically...
Characters, I should say. You're more than one, or you're just playing...
I'm just Miss Sun.
You have enough to do with that one, yes.
Exactly. The interesting part of the play is that she comes in, and it's a challenge, that constant fight. And... It's real because I live that. I am a teaching artist. So it's coming in and trying to show them something different in their way. So that's what she tries to do. And she tries to make that play relate to their lives. And they're like, it's a play written in 1788. So, of course, the kids are like,
And Australian to boot.
Yes. So it is, and it's about a group of convicts. So it gets even more interesting. So seeing the children begin to relate that to their lives, and I really see, as the actor, how she gets excited about that and seeing that growth in that process.
And if I could just say one thing, there's an important line in the play where the kids ask her, when Miss Sun first arrives in the classroom and she's telling them we're going to do a play, they ask her, is it Raisin in the Sun? Yeah. Is it West Side Story? You know, often we tend to go towards what we know because it's easy. Everybody knows Raisin in the Sun, particularly since P. Diddy did it on Broadway. But important, like what Tracy said, is she's trying to bring them something new and different and expand their horizons as it relates to diversity, as it relates to their lives.
Ron DeVette, let me bring you in this conversation. This is a very important role in this play because as I read the play, you're the narrator. You're the guy behind the scenes who talks about everything that's going on.
Right.
You're the Greek chorus, in a sense. Yes.
The character is Jackson Byrne Cofield III, the janitor who's been at the same school since 1958. He was the first Negro janitor there, and he's still there. And he uses that line to push the story forward. They're gone, but I'm still here. Excuse me. He does that a lot. So he wants you to know that he's seen everything. He's been behind the scenes, in front of the scenes. And he feels like he's invisible, but is he really? You know, sometimes we see something in others that we don't see in ourselves, or someone sees something in us that we don't see in ourselves.
So... would you feel comfortable a little bit maybe before we go to our next guest to kind of do a little some pieces from the play?
Sure.
All right, but before we do that, let me just ask, this is about the play again. I'm curious about your company.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about your theater company.
Yes. Kauma Collective, we've been working together now for about 6 years, and we started as a group of students originally from Towson University. I did the MFA in theater program at Towson, and looking around, and we didn't feel like there were a lot of opportunities for black actors, and so we said, let's make our own company, let's do our own shows. And we just kind of started in the studio Black Box Theater at Towson doing work. And then many of us graduated from Towson. And as we entered our professional careers as actors and theater artists, we were still struggling with opportunities for plays that we felt were meaningful and interesting. So we continued to do work together. And I have to give a big shout out to Ann Fulwiler at Theater Project. She supported us from the beginning, and we had our very first show at Theater Project. Since then, we've done things at Creative Alliance, UB Blake Center, Center Stage, basically anyone who will have us to come in and do our works. We've also done prison performances with Mr. Bashi Rose through his prison program in Hagerstown.
Bashi's amazing.
Amazing. Yes. And a big part of our work is about connecting to our community, not art for art's sake, although that's great. We're really about trying to make social political statements that matter and reaching our community through the arts and through original as well as scripted work. So there are about 10 members of Kauma Collective, and it's great working with them.
And you all a member of the collective?
Yes.
Of course.
Proudly.
Yes. So before we have to move on, I'd like to really kind of feel and hear some of this play. What would you like to do? How would you like to, handle
this?
You
want me to start? I'll start from the beginning of the play.
Does that work?
Yes.
I'll just check.
That works. Let's go.
If she says
so
it works.
So what we're about to see, this is a play this weekend at the Creative Alliance, this Friday and Saturday night at 8 p.m., and by the way, the box office number is 410-276-1000. 1651 to see this play, or go to creativealliance.org. We're going to hear a piece in this play called No Child. That was a one-woman play and had rave reviews when she first opened Elijah Sun's play. And they're performing this with a cast here at the Creative Alliance. And the Creative Alliance, by the way, is a place that is one of the few places in town that really opens up to all corners of our community to produce,
yes,
which is white, Latino, African American, everyone. It's just a very important place in our community, and they're going to perform a piece in this play now. The beginning of the play, I think they're going to open it for us, Ron Devick, and Tracy Jiggets.
Trouble in mind, I'm blue, but I won't be blue always, 'cause the sun's going to shine in my back door someday. Hear that? Silence. Beautiful silence. Pure silence. The kind of silence you only get from living in the backwoods. No, we ain't in the backwoods. But I'm thinking about retiring there, though. It's 8:04 a.m. and 5 minutes to the start of day. And we on the second floor of Malcolm X High School here in the Bronx, USA. Right over there is my janitor's closet. Just to the right of the girls' bathroom where the smell of makeup, pomade hair, and gossip fill the morning air. That's Miss Kennedy's office. She the principal. Been leading this pack of delinquents. Oh, I'm sorry. Academically and emotionally challenged youth for 17 years. She got a lot to work with.
Yes.
And that was the opening monologue by Rodney Vick, playing the janitor, who is the group chorus, is the narrator of this play, playing Janitor Barron. And Tracy, you want to...
Yes, I am actually, I'm going to give you a setup.
Okay,
This is towards the end of the play when she is at her wit's end. She is very frustrated, and it has come to the point where she feels like she's going to say goodbye. So this is pretty much her giving her, I can't do this anymore. No, Miss Kennedy, you won't see me on Wednesday. I quit. I came to teaching to touch lives and educate and to be this enchanting artist in the classroom. Instead, I've done nothing but lose 10 pounds in a month and gain a disgusting smoking habit. Those kids in there, they need something much greater than I can give. Those kids need a miracle, and they need one like every day. Look, it seems to me that the whole school system, not just here, but the whole system is falling apart from under us. And if we expect to stay some sort of grand nation for the next 50 years, we got another thing coming. We're not preparing these kids to be leaders. We're getting them ready for jail. Take off your belt. Take off your shoes. Go back, go back, go back. Thank you.
That's a little piece of what you'll hear Friday and Saturday night at the
yes.
Creative Alliance.
Yes.
So how did you end up picking this play to direct?
Well, actually, that's a great question. A wonderful actress by the name of Lizanne Mitchell. She's been featured at Everyman Theater. She's
yes.
been featured at Center Stage. She was working on a play that I saw called Fabulation by Lynn Nottage. And,
oh, yeah, right.
Yes, and uh-huh. she was just a wonderful mentor and friend, and we were talking about the direction of Kaumba Collective, what I wanted to do with the company and with my career, and shows that we should consider. And she had done No Child in New York off Broadway, and she's like, you got to read this piece. You got to find out about this piece. And I didn't know that it had been published for ensemble cast. I'm like, yeah, but that's just a one-woman show. And she's like, no, ensembles are doing it now. So I chased down a copy of the script. I tried to see if I could contact Miss Sun. I talked to friends at Woolly Mammoth because she had done it there in D.C.,
right?
And was able to track down a copy of the script and just started to dissect it and see how we could do it with the full cast. And we just did a read-through of it, and it stuck with many of us because a lot of us are teaching artists as well. Rondi works in the Baltimore City Schools. Tracy does as well. I work in the Baltimore City Schools as well. So it just seemed like such a worthwhile endeavor.
So it's interesting. I think there's a lot of hidden theater in this town. People don't know how much theater we have, and people who are trying to bring the theater alive mm-hmm. in Baltimore. And it's also refreshing for me to see that it hasn't ended, that this is... That the people that other generations are picking up now and coming in to kind of create new, vibrant, alive theater that
yes.
takes the staleness out of life.
Yeah, very exciting.
I know. That's what I love about Baltimore. Like, people tell you you need to be in New York, but Baltimore has a wonderful arts community. I mean, you named, like, Creative Alliance. Whoa, what a wonderful gem in our community. And just, there are a lot of new theater companies, like you said, a lot of young people doing interesting, what they call kitschy and eclectic Baltimore-type work. But it's a thriving artist community.
Yes. It's interesting, though, sometimes in Baltimore, maybe it's changing a bit, that the theater scenes in Baltimore have a kind of, there's always been this divide, a lot, not completely, but there has been a divide between white and black in this community when it comes to theater. Very little melding goes on.
Yeah.
Well, I myself, as an actress, I've had the opportunity to work with everyone. So it's about going out there, and because there are definitely opportunities. I know Kaumba as a group, we work with everyone, definitely.
So what comes up next for Kaumba after this? You have any thoughts about what you're doing next?
Yes, well, we have a big party coming up on June 20th. It's our annual art party and fundraiser. It's going to be at Center Stage Theater on Saturday, June 20th. We're actually raising funds to attend the National Black Theater Festival down in Winston-Salem. The National Black Theater Festival is a long-standing tradition for artists, and people come from all over the nation to do plays, and we're hoping to go down there and do a workshop, maybe a performance. So we're trying to raise funds for that. We're also raising funds to do some stuff this summer. We're trying to be out in parks and do some outdoor theater and activities with young people in local summer camps.
I love this. This is great. So folks, do not miss this. This weekend at the Creative Alliance, Kaumba Theater presents No Child, directed by Roslyn Cawthon, Tracy Jiggets, Rondi Vick, two of the actors in this play. And it's a great theater space. And it'll be a wonderful evening. I want to thank you all so much. You can check on our website and get tickets and go and enjoy yourselves. And thank you so much for keeping theater alive in Baltimore.
Thank you, Mark. And thank you for always supporting the arts.
Yes.
It's part of our job. Thank you so much. Good to have you all here.
Bye-bye.
Good luck.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Before we jump into this conversation out of our Urbanite Radio stories, I want to remind you that earlier today I interviewed Michael Pollan, who's one of the leading thinkers about food in our society, who's changing the way we think about eating. He's the author of Omnivore's Dilemma, many other books and articles, and we'll bring you that interview on the Mark Steiner Show this month on May 26th, so stay tuned. But in the meantime, you'll have a chance to hear Michael Pollan in person this Saturday at the Enoch Pratt Library. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. The event begins at 7 p.m. But right now, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite delves into hidden phenomena, shadowy characters, undisclosed locations, and the mysteries of Baltimore. It's the secrets issue. Available now at over 800 locations around the region and online at urbanitebaltimore.com. And we produce every month a series of Urbanite radio stories and conversations. This is one of them. And our guest is Clinton McSherry, food and drink writer for Urbanite magazine. And we are going to talk about the Preakness and his favorite drink recipe and more. And Clinton, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Mark, thanks. It's great to be here.
So I love the way you began this article about how Baltimore is kind of the stepchild of the Triple Crown.
It seems that way. You know, I was watching the Derby coverage on ESPN. I'm not a huge horse guy, but I can't keep myself away from the Triple Crown and the Breeders' Cup and a couple other races. But ESPN was driving me crazy. They kept saying that the Derby was the oldest major sporting event in the country. You know, it's not even the oldest Triple Crown race. The Preakness was first run in 1873, 2 years before the inaugural Derby, 2 years, in fact, before Churchill Downs even opened. But they kept saying it, and anyway, such is life.
Because your world is not so much horses as it is food and
yeah.
good wine and interesting drinks and
yeah. We had a horse racing, Mark, really appeals to my sense of my fondness really for cocktail lore and for local history because they really are intertwined here in Maryland. You know, horse racing here in Maryland predates that in Kentucky. I mean, Bully Rock, we know that mostly as a golf course now, but Bully Rock was the first thoroughbred brought to this country, and has, you know, Maryland has just a terrific history in that regard. It's sadly, of course, as we all know, facing a lot of difficulties right now, but that's not the way it should be.
We don't want the Maryland Preakness to go the way of Maryland's rye whiskey.
We sure don't. We sure don't. You know, it's funny, and this, you know, thematically for this issue of the Urbanite, you know, rye is very much a vanished institution. I think it really fits in with the whole Baltimore mystery theme that the Urbanite put out in this issue.
It is. Well, it's interesting. I like the way this kind of is all connected. I mean that you did a really interesting article here about
thank you
the Preakness and about the drinks that made up the Preakness. What we're going to talk about here, you can actually go to the Urbanite and see the Horsey Hilltop. We're going to talk about the recipe for this drink that we're talking about here, that we rye whiskey is probably the oldest whiskey in the country.
So. It absolutely is. In fact, rye has a long history in Maryland. You know, rum was the initial drink of the colonies, but especially during the Revolution, rum was not available because the Brits controlled all that. And in fact, it would have been unpatriotic had it been here to drink tea,
you drank coffee in the early American Revolution because you were right. Exactly.
London Coffee House in Fells Point has that history cornered, I think. But yeah, so rye was especially prevalent here in Maryland and also in Pennsylvania. And, it, you know, the grain was grown for a variety of reasons. But when I think the farmers of the day discovered that they could distill rye into liquor, it became a form of barter. It was a lot easier to transport the liquor to market than it was to transport the raw grain. So it was not just a more transportable commodity. It was also a more valuable commodity in a lot of ways. Of the two, by the way, I think it's kind of interesting. You know, there was Monongahela rye, which was associated with Western Pennsylvania, and Maryland rye. Maryland rye was always considered to be the more refined of the two.
And now there's no longer any more rye whiskey distilled in the state of Maryland.
No, it's a shame. It's a real shame.
Pikesville rye was the last one. Is that right?
Pikesville was the last one. Most of them, you know, huge industry and very much centered in Baltimore, although certainly in other parts of the state as well. There were, oh gosh, You probably know Jim Brady, who was a gentleman journalist of the old school. Mm-hmm. He wrote the definitive article on Maryland rye, especially pre-prohibition Maryland rye, for the Maryland Historical Magazine in 1990. Terrific piece. I'd commend your listeners to it. But you know, prohibition did away with most of them. It was pretty much the death knell for Maryland rye. There were a few that hung on afterwards. Pikesville was the last holdout. Pikesville was last made as a Maryland rye here in the Baltimore area in 1972. The distillery kept in operation, but it wasn't. It was just a distributor.
There was always a bottle of Pikesville rye in my mother's kitchen.
You know what, Mark? It was my parents' tipple of choice as well. You know, whether it was a matter of principle or palate, I'm not sure. But once Pikesville left Maryland, they stopped drinking it.
So very quickly, before we start this little taste test you have here, and I'm looking forward to this little taste test we're about to have, and you're going to mix this, are you?
Yeah.
All right. So what's the essential difference between rye whiskey, Irish whiskey, bourbon? I mean, what's the difference?
It typically involves the grain that's used to distill. So for bourbon, it's corn. For scotch, it's generally barley. Rye is rye. And there are other varieties like Canadian whiskey. You know, for after rye started to disappear from the shelves, people mistakenly would call Canadian rye. But Canadian's made from any number of grains, but primarily wheat, which is peculiarly tasteless. It's just it's an abomination.
So, other than an excuse to taste old-fashioned rye and see which one's the best, which we're about to do, and also have this drink that I'm going to get to. What is the connection here between this and the Preakness? Other than an excuse to try a piece of whiskey.
Well, you know, the Black-Eyed Susan. We call that the traditional drink of the Preakness, which is
right.
quite frankly. Let's see, how to say this politely and radio. It doesn't deserve to be called the traditional drink of the Preakness. It only dates back to 1973. And in fact, it was concocted simply as a marketing technique to sell commemorative glasses. People figured at that day, well, the Derby has its julep, so we've got to do something. And they came up with this drink they called the Black Eyed Susan. As soon as they came up with it, it started to mutate. I mean, there are at least five different recipes that I found. It started out being made with vodka and rum and triple sec. At some point, Frank DeFrancis, who owned Pimlico at the time and owned the Jockey Club, he insisted on changing it to peach schnapps. And that became one of the core ingredients in it. Eventually, Early Times became a sponsor of the Preakness, so bourbon became a, this drink has no tradition. I mean, whatever its age, it just has no tradition, no claim to our loyalty. Rye does. Rye was certainly what they drank along with good Gunther or American beer that was brewed in Baltimore at the track in the old
Gunther's
days.
I remember Gunther's beer.
Baltimore was as big a brewing place as it was a distilling place, of course. So beer, rye whiskey, that's what people drank at Pimlico.
All right, so now what is this little array of things you have in front of us here?
Well,
and by the way, I would reintroduce our guest, Dr. Clinton McSherry, food and drink writer for the Urbanite magazine. There was an interesting article that we are making to one of the Urbanite radio stories this hour, these last 50 minutes, on Pony Time, a triple crown salute to Maryland's original whiskey, that is rye whiskey. And he's concocted something for us. I want to remind you that I want to thank the Wine Source at 3601 Elm Avenue in Hamden, at the corner of Elm and 36, for their generous support for this segment and helping us have this rye whiskey here to taste.
Great. Mark, what we have in front of us are three bottles of rye. One is Jim Beam, one is Pikesville, although it's made in Kentucky now, and the third is Wild Turkey. Let's see. What I'm going to suggest we do, Mark, if it's okay with you,
mm-hmm.
sample a little bit of each, decide which one we like the most, and then we'll make the Horsey Hilltop with that.
Okay.
Sound good?
Are we doing a blind test? We're just going to do this?
Nah, it's...
Let that mic follow you.
Not necessary. Will do.
All right.
Now, it just so happens that I have had this Jim Beam version fairly recently.
You have? Well, I've been a while. Let's give this a taste. This is the Jim Beam, is it? Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy.
Whoa! The wrong pipe.
Sorry about that.
Coughing as you drink is not a good idea.
No.
That's interesting. That's,
Well, I'll tell you what I think about it. I don't mean to jump the gun here, but I'm not crazy about Beam, and I'll tell you, it just tastes like pretty generic whiskey.
I was about to say that. It says there's nothing special about the taste of this whiskey at all.
I agree 100%. It doesn't have what I associate with, well, I don't, not just me. It doesn't have rye character. Rye is typically considered to be not as sweet as bourbon, not as smoky as scotch, but I frankly hate to use those terms because that's defining rye by what it isn't. I think what makes rye so interesting is its spicy character. It can be hot sometimes, but not unpleasantly so. And it's often got a sort of a pepperiness, even a grassiness to it sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that's what really characterizes old school Maryland rye.
Well, let's see if Maryland rye works.
Let's try a little bit
what that is like. This is the Pikesville rye, which is the original, the last Maryland rye to be made of the many ryes. It was our home state drink. And anybody my age, perhaps a little younger, will remember this was Maryland's drink. Our able engineer and chief operation officer here, Zachary Coleman, told me as we were about to do the show that the only reason I know about rye whiskey is because I'm old. So maybe that is the case.
That might just be it.
Let's see. This is the rye. This is the Maryland rye.
Yeah, and one thing you can tell just from looking at it, it's got a slightly darker color.
Mm-hmm.
It is also on sort of the value model. You can still find Pikesville all across the state. Even, places like Ocean City, they'll tell you this is the only rye that sells, and it's because of the name. But there are some tasters. I will tell you, I have not tasted this in a long, long time.
I haven't either, actually.
There are some tasters who think this is very much underappreciated, especially in this price range. Let's see what we
I've always been more of an Irish whiskey man, but
that's a hot beverage right now.
Mm.
Much more interesting, I think.
Yeah.
It's got a lot. The flavors, wow, nice little bite at the end.
It's very grainy.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, some people, when they're trying to compare the tastes of different whiskeys, will actually talk about the grain. I mean, compare what cornbread tastes like compared to what rye bread tastes like.
Right.
It seems a little simplistic, but that does have some, resonance. That's not bad stuff.
Something you can't really taste this way when you do shots.
No. No.
You know,
I know a great old bartender in Canton, the guy, very old school, Billy McHugh's his name. He drinks like you. He's an Irish drinker. He says people who bang it down, they're missing the whole experience.
Yeah, that's exactly.
You know, it's
like taking a good glass of wine and just shoving it down your gullet without tasting the wine going down.
What's the point?
Exactly. Life was too short for that.
Agreed. Agreed.
So now we're going to try...
Let's try the wild turkey.
Wild turkey and see what they do. Now, I've had other wild turkeys. I've not had rye wild turkey.
Right. Now, just for a point of reference, both the previous two were 80 proof. The wild turkey is 101 proof.
All right. Well...
Now, wild turkey has been making rye for a good long time. They're, I think, a pretty respected producer. And let's see how we like it. They have, in fact, come out with a premium rye. Artisan Spirits are really taking over the market. Well, I shouldn't say taking over the market, but they've developed a real craft niche for themselves in the same way that craft beer has become a real popular item. And there is a higher tier rye from Wild Turkey called Russell's Reserve, which I have tried and like very, very much.
This Wild Turkey, the aroma is not as pungent as the aroma from the Pikesville.
I agree.
It's much smoother. Doesn't have quite as much of an aroma. Different aroma, I should say.
Boy, much more base notes in that flavor.
Yeah. Whoa. This has a real aftertaste.
Yeah.
Kind of really can feel it in your mouth when you finished.
Black pepper. I get a lot. It reminds me of the feeling as well as a little bit of the taste of black pepper on the end.
This is a much more refined of the three.
I would think so. Yeah. No, I agree. That's absolutely my impression too, Mark.
Wild Turkey has always made a good whiskey.
Yes, they have. Yes, they have.
I'm sure the whiskey. I don't smoke cigarettes, but whiskey is one of those things that always makes me want to have a cigarette, which is why it's dangerous. But I don't smoke anymore, but it's got that kind of... I don't know why whiskey does that.
Well, you still have the voice for radio, Mark. It's helping your instrument, right?
There you go. Right. I'll tell Valerie that when I get home.
Well, now, the sad thing is these are all decent products in their regard. I agree with you, Mark. I think the Wild Turkey is the star of the show. But, I read one distiller comment that, they spill more bourbon in a day than they sell rye in a year. that's how diminished the market.
I mean, until this moment, I have to tell you, until this moment, now I have spent some time with Irish whiskey and some Scotch, but this is the first time I've really spent time discerning the flavor of rye whiskey.
What do you think?
I like it a lot. I mean, it really is very different. I mean, it's you really hit me with your description when you talk about kind of the grassy flavor, kind of earthiness. Of rye as different than the smokiness of Scotch.
Well, and originally, Mark, back in, even as late as the early part of this century, this was the whiskey that bartenders used in fancy hotels when they were making cocktails. The original Manhattan was certainly made with rye. The original Sazerac, well, Sazerac's got an interesting history itself, but when Sazeracs were made with whiskey, they were made with rye. It's only been really post-Prohibition and even more so post-World War II that bourbon has become sort of the default brown drink, if you will.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So now tell us about this drink you're about to mix. And do you think the Wild Turkey?
I think so.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
So tell me what you're about to do here as we talk to our listeners. And we're talking, by the way, with Clinton McSherry about his piece from Urbanite magazine on a forgotten drink of the Preakness, of the real Maryland drink of rye whiskey. The Preakness, of course, is this Saturday. We'll see who wins that. And we want to keep the Preakness in Maryland, even if it doesn't stay at Pimlico, it needs to stay in Maryland.
Absolutely.
What are we about to do here?
Okay.
Clinton.
At my very fancy test lab at home, Mark. I concocted a concocted a drink. I generally drink whiskey when I drink it. I drink it with just a little bit of ice. But, you know, the Black Eyed Susan is just such an abomination that I felt compelled to come up with an alternative.
We have about 4 or 5 minutes till we end this hour. So let me see what we have, what you have in store for us here.
Okay. Well, the Horsey Hilltop is named for Outerbridge Horsey, who was a gentleman and a politico around the turn of the – actually, in the 19th century, lived into the 20th. He produced what was arguably the finest Maryland rye of all time called Horsey's Very Fine. I'm going to keep – you know, Mark, do you have your glass? We can
– Sure.
That's your Wild Turkey glass?
That's the Wild Turkey glass right there.
Good. Okay. And he produced – what was called Old Horsey Very Fine Rye Whiskey. Again, one of the it was the rye of country clubs and the finest hotels around the country. He sadly passed away in the early 1900s, and his distillery, which was out near Frederick, decided to make their whiskey using corn, which is a very sad betrayal. But
that is a betrayal.
Things happen. In any case. That hence the name Horsey. There's perhaps a
little bit of
words too. Yeah, that's a that's a nice one.
There we are.
And of course, so that accounts for the Horsey in the name. The Hilltop of course refers to our beloved Pimlico. Now, you know, Pimlico is called Old Hilltop. I used to think it was called Old Hilltop because of its location in the city. You know, you sort of drive up Northern Parkway, and you
right.
sort of it seems like you're at the. Seems like you're just sort of at the top of the city in some ways. But no, and it turns out that in the middle of the infield, for many, many years, there was a big hill in the middle of the infield. Now, Alfred Gwynne Vanderbilt bought Pimlico in the 30s, if I'm not mistaken, and then went on to level it. He did a big wave of improvements to Pimlico, in fact, prior to the Seabiscuit War Admiral race.
Which was the most famous races in American racing,
absolutely.
Horse racing history right here in Baltimore. Another reason not to forget the Preakness North Pimlico is a great racetrack.
That's right.
Despite what some people have done to it.
And so Vanderbilt, one of his improvements to the track was leveling that hill, but the name Old Hilltop remains.
So this is
a Horsey Hilltop. I make it this way, Mark. I take a quarter teaspoon of brown sugar, pour a half teaspoon of fresh lemon juice over that, and just all you need to do is just shake it around the bottom of a glass, and it'll dissolve. To that, I add. Got 1 second for you, Mark. I'm sorry, I gave it to you a little too fast.
That's okay.
To that, I add 2 ounces of the whiskey, then some ice,
a little bitters,
dash or two of bitters.
Okay.
And top it off with a twist of lemon. Like to rub it around because, you know, what you're doing when you twist the lemon is you're sort of releasing the oil from the skin. Rub it around the top of the glass. And then drop it on in.
All right. So let's see what this is like. Here we go. And the name of our drink again is, Clinton?
The Horsey Hilltop.
The Horsey Hilltop.
Coming to a Preakness party near you, we hope.
I hope. Maybe this Saturday at my house.
And what I try to do here, in so many cocktails really mask what the liquor tastes like. I really try to avoid that whenever I do it. That's not the point. It's not supposed to take place.
No, this is really a lovely drink, and you can taste the rye.
Good. The brown sugar mark is important. If you just have white sugar, you probably should just drink it straight.
Clinton McSherry, it's been a pleasure to have you in the studio. Good to see you once again.
Thank you, Mark.
Food and drink writer for Urbanite magazine, and the recipe for Clinton's new Preakness drink, the Horsey Hilltop, is in this month's issue of Urbanite magazine. Try it. Watch the Preakness, even in the comfort of your own home, and enjoy it.
Down the stretch they come.
One of my favorite Urbanite radio stories has been just now. I love this. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Christina Arison, Brian Boone, and Jackson Hubold. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional new interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And again, we want to thank all of you for tuning in and being part of this show today. and thank the Wine Source for their contribution to the show today as well. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.